From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. With the weekend beginning and New Year's Eve just a few days away, on this edition of Fresh Air, we talk movies. James Toback tells us about writing the screenplay for Bugsy. Toback used to be a compulsive gambler, so writing a screenplay about the gangster who created Las Vegas was right up his alley. If you're thinking about renting videos for the weekend or New Year's Eve, we'll try to help. Film critic Peter Rayner has some overlooked comedies to recommend. Michael Barson suggests forgotten B-films of the 50s. And if you're interested in reading about how movies get made, book critic John Leonard recommends The Devil's Candy, reporter Julie Salomon's account of the making of the film version of Bonfire of the Vanities. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A Swedish DC-9 airliner with 129 passengers and crew lost power to both its engines and crash-landed today north of Stockholm. The pilot called it a miracle that no one was killed. Roger Wall has filed this report for the BBC.
When rescue teams located the plane some 45 minutes after the crash, they found an amazing sight. The plane had flown under a high-tension power line, plowed through a patch of forest, and come to rest, split into three parts in one of the few open patches in this densely wooded area. The 6,000 litres of fuel had not been ignited, and the passengers were shuddering in the cold. They told rescue workers that there had been no panic and evacuation had been orderly, though most ran away as fast as they could, fearing the plane would explode. One told us of his amazement at having survived the crash landing.
I was astonished that we were still alive, and there was some shouting, of course, out, out, people moving up to the emergency exits.
Only one passenger from the crash is still in hospital with serious injuries.
Roger Wallace in Stockholm. Rebel forces in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia captured the secret police headquarters in Tbilisi today and freed eight political prisoners, including the main opposition leader. The rebels still have President Zviad Gamsakhourdia besieged in the parliament, and the two sides exchanged fire for the sixth day in a row. Gamsakhourdia gave a television interview from his bunker under the parliament, saying he will not surrender. He called his opponents liars and terrorists, but repeated earlier efforts to open talks with them if they stop fighting. The rebels say that Gamsakhourdia, the republic's first democratically elected president, has become a dictator. The United States has rejected a Libyan invitation to send American and British observers to the trial of two men who were charged with carrying out the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. 270 people died when the plane blew up over Lockerbie, Scotland in 1988. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports.
Gaddafi told Britain's Independent Television News that the U.S. and Great Britain were free to send anyone they wished to observe the trial. They can even bring independent judges to handle the case, Gaddafi said, but he ruled out handing over the two accused to the U.S. or Britain. Libya's foreign minister, in a newspaper interview published today, said his country was also willing to send judges to Washington and London to discuss the Lockerbie bombing, which killed 270 people. The U.S. and Great Britain have insisted that the two men implicated be tried in the West and are warning of sanctions if Libya does not comply. They've also refused to rule out military action. But in his television interview, Gaddafi said he doubted President Bush would repeat the 1986 attack on Tripoli ordered by President Reagan, a move backed by then-British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Speaking of President Bush and British Prime Minister John Major, Gaddafi said they are different from both Reagan and Thatcher, and I don't think they would commit such injustices. I'm Michael Sullivan in London.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials gained 18.5 points to close at a record 3,101. This is NPR. The Boston Globe reported today that Israel is planning a massive airlift to rescue Soviet Jews if there should be another coup or civil war in the former Soviet Union. The story quoted an Israeli official who estimated that such an airlift could evacuate as many as 100,000 people a month. The airlift would be similar to one used to bring Ethiopian Jews to Israel earlier this year. Officials in Maine have sued the Air Force, saying a decision to close Loring Air Force Base was unfair. Loring is one of several dozen bases scheduled to close over the next several years. Jennifer Ludden of Maine Public Broadcasting reports.
When a federal commission voted to close Loring earlier this year, one member said the base's quality of life was poor because of its isolated location in northern Maine. He said few people in the Air Force wanted to locate here. Local and state leaders charged that was not a legal basis for closing Loring. The lawsuit also alleges the Air Force wrongly evaluated how much it would cost to keep the base open. The suit's backers include three of Maine's four congressional delegates, Maine's governor, and local officials. A similar lawsuit to keep the Philadelphia Naval Shipyard open was dismissed this fall. It's being appealed. For National Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Ludden.
A consumer advocacy group charged today that an Amtrak passenger train was speeding when it derailed last week in Florida, injuring 55 people. The statement was issued by Ross Kappen, head of the National Association of Railroad Passengers. Kappen said that he was told by Amtrak President Graham Clater that the train was traveling at 72 miles per hour when it jumped the track and smashed into two unoccupied houses. That would be more than twice the posted speed limit of 30 miles per hour. So far, there's been no comment on the statement from the Amtrak president. Kappen said the only possible explanations for such speeding would be brake failure or operator error. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new film Bugsy was written by my guest, James Toback. Bugsy is about Ben Bugsy Siegel, the gangster who virtually invented Las Vegas when he came up with the idea of building a palatial gambling casino in the middle of the Nevada desert. Bugsy is played by Warren Beatty. Annette Bening plays Virginia Hill, the starlet he falls in love with. This is the scene in which they meet. Bugsy is trying to pick up Virginia. He's just found out she's involved with another gangster. She's just found out Bugsy's married to a woman named Esta.
Now, what exactly does Mr. Esta want from Miss Virginia?
Right now, Mr. Esta is having a tremendous amount of difficulty imagining anything he doesn't want from Miss Virginia.
Oh, I'll bet he could pull a rabbit out of his hat if he really tried.
Yeah.
Are you ready for a divorce, Mr. Siegel?
Never.
Wow. My, oh, my, you're pretty ferocious where Mom's concerned, aren't you?
Yeah.
The rest of the time, you're just another good-looking, sweet-talking, charm-oozing fellow with nothing to offer but some dialogue. Why don't you run outside and jerk yourself a soda?
Dialogue written by my guest James Toback. Toback also wrote the screenplay for The Gambler, and he wrote and directed Fingers, Love and Money, Exposed, and The Pickup Artist. Toback says his involvement with the film Bugsy dates back to 1984. He had approached his friend Warren Beatty for a loan. Beatty had a different idea. If Toback wrote a screenplay for Beatty about Bugsy Siegel, Beatty would give Toback the money he needed as an advance. Toback loved the idea and thought he was the perfect choice to write the film.
I felt possessed in some strange way by Bugsy's spirit. I don't want to get too mystical because I'm not really, I don't believe these things literally, but I felt that from the time I first looked at photographs of Bugsy and then started reading about him, that I understood who he was, that I understood the kind of Jew that he was. A very strange mix of qualities went into Bugsy Siegel. He was from a lower middle class Jewish family with ambitions to raising itself. His brother became a well-known Beverly Hills doctor. You were supposed to be a good boy and get an education. Bugsy was extremely smart, liked by almost everybody, but was also homicidal. He had a tender streak, a well-mannered, courtly streak. He was sexually obsessed, but he killed without any compunction whatsoever. This mix in an American Jew struck me as fascinating and also, in some odd way that I probably shouldn't investigate too thoroughly, understandable.
How come it took 7 years to finish the screenplay?
Well, I was rightly suspicious that I was not going to be asked to direct this movie. And since my five most recent films I'd written and directed, and since I think of directing as a process which is simply an extension of the writing that I've done, I didn't really like the idea of finishing and then finding I wasn't going to be directing it. So I think I unconsciously fought against finishing it. Then finally, when a gun was put to my head, figuratively if not literally, by Beatty, which is to say that he heard that he knew that Fox was going to do some, you know, Joel Silver ripoff special on a, you know, like violent gangster movie with Bugsy Siegel as the main character. And basically what he said to me is either you're going to finish this script or give me this script, or the movie's never going to get done because they'll do a Bugsy Siegel, and whether it stinks or not, ours will never get made. So that spurred me on. I finished it, and then a great collaboration, surprisingly enough, ensued.
How did you want Bugsy to be different from other gangster films?
Well, I never really saw it as a gangster film. I saw it as a film about a romantically yearning, overreaching, impatient, wildly complicated guy who happened to live the life of a gangster, more in the past than in the part of the movie I was concerned about. In other words, the Bugsy Siegel we know as a gangster really established himself up to the point the movie starts. Our movie starts, Bugsy starts, with Bugsy leaving New York for L.A., where he's going to take over the rackets in L.A., which in fact he does, and so there's that gangster's element in L.A., but essentially what he really wants to be is a star. And while he can't be a star on screen like his friend George Raft, he can and is a star off screen, and his true creation then becomes Las Vegas. He wants to build the city in the desert.
What were some of the places you went and people you hung out with to write the screenplay to really get in the spirit for this movie?
Well, on a certain level, the place I spent time with was in my own core of dementia, which is to say that I wrote the character from the inside out. I felt my way into Bugsy, saw what was in me that was in Bugsy, which I always try to do with a character, see the world from that character's point of view. Then for the specifics, I listened to all the FBI tapes to get a sense of his language. I read a great deal. I know Las Vegas inside out, although Las Vegas today is nothing like what Bugsy originally had in mind. I talked to loads of people that he'd known, so I sort of digested things along the way.
Where did you go in Vegas?
Well, I spent a lot of time at the in the Bugsy suite at the Flamingo, now called Flamingo Hilton. It's owned by Hilton Hotels. And suite 44,000 is the actually Bugsy suite there. It's the original building, which is now dwarfed by two 30-story glass towers. But his room exists pretty much the way it was then, his suite. So I spent a lot of time there and wrote a lot of the script there. And I would think of that building being what it was, Bugsy's building, and his suite being his suite, and at the same time looking out at this monstrosity, this vulgar display of garishness and madness and greed that the city has become.
You have been an inveterate gambler. I don't know if you're still gambling now, but did you end up gambling and losing a lot of money while writing the screenplay?
Let's put it this way, rather than going into specifics. Gambling is a, I believe, genetic obsession, compulsion, which never leaves anyone who has it any more than alcoholism does or drug addiction does, and I think it's just a question of behavioral eruptions, and I've had my share of them.
Seems to me there's something fundamentally self-destructive about someone who's a gambler like you, who's trying to not gamble as much, writing a screenplay about Bugsy Siegel, and then having to spend a lot of time in Vegas to do the research.
Well, I look at my work as the primary justification for hanging around. The one thing everybody knows from the day he's born is that he's going to die. And after a certain point, when you've experienced quite a bit and experimented, as I had at a rather early age, I would say by 24 or 25, I had done most of what my fantasy life had reached into. I think you need some kind of justification to say, I choose to live rather than to die. And for me, that justification is making movies. It's doing work that I consider worthwhile and interesting and exciting and ambitious, and then trying to execute it as well as I can. And if it leads me to the North Pole, it leads me to the North Pole. If I get in trouble as a result, I get in trouble as a result. But my goal is not to lead a necessarily a life the median. It's not to get comfortable and happy in any conventional sense. It's to be able somehow to reach beyond where I've been before and do something that will I feel, justify my time on Earth.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Toback. He wrote the screenplay for the new movie Bugsy. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. James Toback is my guest, and in addition to writing the screenplay for Bugsy, he wrote and directed Fingers, The Pickup Artist, Love and Money, Exposed, and his most recent film that he directed was The Big Bang. You've written the screenplay for Bugsy as a story about a criminal who loves movies and in a way wants to be a movie star, and his good friend George Raft, played by Joe Mantegna, who's a movie star, but who's also connected with gangsters. What interests you in this connection between crime and film?
Well, film releases one from moral constraint in a way that no other art form does. It's the most expressionistic and irrational of the arts. And
that's certainly how you've used it.
Yes, and that's the kind of film that appeals to me, and I think that that sort of frees the imagination to run amok, and it's fun to let the imagination run amok when you don't, you know, to commit crimes on screen and not get arrested for them because you didn't do it in real life. What more can you ask?
So why are you're fascinated both by movies and by gangsters?
Well, I'm fascinated by crime more than gangsters. I'm fascinated by the idea that you do not allow other people to draw limits and lines around your behavior. That is to say, who are these people who tell you what is right and wrong? Well, it's obvious on the practical level. It's society that gets together, appoints certain people, or if it's a monarchy, it's done that way. And then you can't do this, you can do that, you'll go to jail if you do that. That's all rather simple on that level. But finally, who are they? They're just other human beings. Why do they have the capacity to tell you what is right or wrong in your life? Why don't you have the ability yourself to decide? And I think that that writing about characters who live that way or who think that way is fundamentally more interesting to me than writing about characters who pretty much take for granted, as most people do, that you behave the way the law, that is to say, other people tell you to behave.
Now, you went to ethical culture school. I'm not even sure what that is, but it certainly doesn't sound like the kind of background you should have come out of to feel the way you do about crime and perversity.
Well, ethical culturism is a kind of rational, agnostic movement that broke away from Reform Judaism at the turn of the century. And, you know, I mean, I believe in all kinds of ethical precepts, and I think I practice them. I have my own ethical code, and it actually is not all that different from the ethical code that it suffuses the ethical culture movement. I just think that to try to deny the endless complexities of human nature is, A, reductive and much less interesting, and, B, in the long run, an invitation to catastrophe, because self-knowledge, I think, always helps to get you on the right track. And self-deception, which is to say to view oneself and other people with a chimerically evasive, sugar-coated notion, is does no one any good.
So when you were going to ethical culture school, was that about the same time that you started gambling also and hanging out at places that?
Harvard was what opened the door for me. I was leading a kind of curious other life when I was at ethical culture. I had friends who were not of that world, but Harvard was the one that where the floodgates were open, because Boston and Cambridge, that and in the middle 60s, was a kind of laboratory at the time for experimentation. You had the whole drug movement, counterculture. You had a kind of violent black world there. You had a gambling world. You had the dynamic of romantic and sexual experimentation. You had an academic world. You had a lot of foreign students, whom I got to, Latin American students, sons of dictators and stuff, socialists, communists. It was a terrific mix. And in those 3 years, I felt as if I were experiencing everything that was going on in the world.
And that's how you started gambling when you were at Harvard?
Gambling, I started right around that time. But gambling, has had a kind of strange. It sort of comes and goes. It's in my life. It's out of my life. It's in. It's out. I don't learn anything from it anymore, which is why it would be a good thing never to do it again. And I am actually at a point now where I don't even like to say this, because until have been a couple of years when I haven't done it, but I feel I sort of purged it from my system now, and that there's no real point in doing it anymore, and that I therefore won't. But there's a point at which it was a learning experience for me, too, and I got a lot from it psychologically and sociologically. That point is past. There's nothing new for me to learn.
So what did you get out of gambling when you were younger?
I got, apart from the sociological observations, seeing, you know, what people behaved like under circumstances of stress and danger and risk and compulsion and obsession. I got an understanding of my own flirtations with extinction, because after all, gambling is really a kind mini version, a kind of microcosmic version of a life and death exchange. You basically say, I'm either dead or I'm alive. I'm going to shoot my wad. I'm buried. I'm alive. They use this language. It's part of a gambler's lingo. You know, you say, I'm alive in the daily double, or I'm dead, or I'm history. It's filled with life and death feelings. You end up accepting your own mortality in a strange way if you gamble for a while in an intense atmosphere. It forces you into these feelings of total loss and devastation. Now, obviously, life itself provides those, and I don't think that anyone's going to be immune from it, but gambling is a kind of heightened, condensed, artificial way of giving you that sort of gruesome education in the suddenness of obliteration.
Did you ever end up owing money to loan sharks, for instance, and end up not being able to just observe other people and gamble but remain on the sidelines, but rather be kind of drawn into the action because you owed money? I guess I'm asking if you were ever beaten up or threatened in a way that physically involved you beyond what you wanted.
No, I've always done it I've always known how to handle myself in whatever area I've gotten into, and I've been very, very careful to do. The real illegality has nothing to do with the real danger of gambling. The real danger of gambling is that you will lose not just what you do have, but what you don't have. And that's why this whole Bugsian dream in Las Vegas now is so fascinating, because what Bugsy really was after was a kind of city in the desert, a kind of wild creation. And what Las Vegas has become is a place that people go to, basically. Forget the middle American convention image that they like to project. What they really have created is a place where ordinary people who are not basically addicted, who have not yet fallen off the cliff, go and do fall off the cliff. I don't mean all of them. I don't even mean most of them. But let's say the 10%, and I'm guessing at the figure. Maybe it's more, maybe it's less. But a considerable number of people come to Las Vegas thinking they're going to have fun, to do this, to do that, and basically they get wiped out. They lose everything they have. Their entire lives are changed in some fundamental way. There's no other city in America that provides this service, and I use the word ironically, obviously. And that's really, as I say, gambling is that's the fascination of it. It's a kind of laboratory for psychic extremes. You're forced into, even if you're perfectly legitimate and legal, you sit at a blackjack table for 4 hours, and everything you worked for 30 years is gone.
Did you see a lot of that?
I've seen it over and over and over again. I've seen major entertainers, people who are in the public eye, reduced to begging on their knees and sobbing because they want just one more chance, one more bit of credit so that they can continue to try to win back what they've lost. People who are beyond where they're even going to be able to entertain for free, where they've said, just give me another credit, I'll sing for another 2 weeks, I'll sing for this. You already have to do that. Well, I'll do it next year. I mean, the depths of desperation. But Las Vegas is the only city where people come, little do they know, I think, in many, many cases, to be reduced to nothingness.
Earlier you were talking about your interest in Jewish criminals. As someone who is Jewish, what did it mean to you to personally to find that there was a sector of American crime that was Jewish? You know, a lot of people look for all kinds of things to affirm their heritage and affirm their roots. You wouldn't think that finding gangsters would be the thing that did it, but what did that do for you?
Well, I find it, I think it makes it much more interesting. It makes the Jewish experience in America much more rich and complex, and there is a certain kind of Jew who's very embarrassed about this sort of stuff, and I find that embarrassing. I find the embarrassment embarrassing. We did a documentary for Showtime on the making of Bugsy, and we were going to shoot in the cemetery, the Jewish cemetery where Bugsy's buried in L.A., and the rabbi there would not let us shoot there because he's embarrassed to have Bugsy buried there and doesn't want anyone to know that this criminal, this killer, is buried in this Jewish cemetery. To me, that's utterly insane. It's, you know, the sort of is it good for the Jews defensive mentality that in the long run, I just think breeds more anti-Semitism, not less. That is to say, when you go in saying, we should be on our best behavior because we're in an alien land filled with anti-Semites and they're all going to get us unless we cower in a corner and obey all the rules and act accordingly. We cannot break the law because we're lucky to be here and other people can break it, but we can't. To me, full citizenship comes when you're ready to admit to the full diversity and colors of your nature and of your history and of your past.
I think it's fair to say that in Hollywood you're known as an eccentric. How does the success of Bugsy affect your profile in Hollywood?
Well, I think that, you know, anyone who's been at all out of the mainstream in his behavior and gotten away with certain things, I mean, I've been able to make movie after movie, and some people have loved them, some have hated them, but I've gotten them made, I've gotten them done the way I've wanted to do them. You have people lying in wait for you, you know. There are people who want to see you fail, who are dying to see you fail, and I think this makes that a bitterer pill for them, for enemies. It means to friends that they're happy to see that I've succeeded in a way that they recognize more as success, and that's nice. I mean, it's nice that I have, you know, that to see, because there've been loads and loads of calls and people who care about you. That's very nice. For practical reasons, it's nice because I think it'll make the next movie that much easier to set up. The way I look at it is, and it's true of reviews too, it's great to get beautifully written reviews, which we've had a lot of that were raves and all that, but it's all finally practical. Does this stuff help you to do your next movie or not? And in this case, I think it probably does. So that's all to the good, because making a movie is not like writing a novel. You need all this money all the time to do it, and it's a struggle.
James Toback, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been James Toback, and he wrote the screenplay for Bugsy. He also wrote the screenplay for The Gambler and wrote and directed Fingers, The Pickup Artist, and Love and Money. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. New Year's Eve is a big night for renting movies. Some video stores get nearly cleaned out. If you're looking for movies to rent, we have some recommendations. Film critic Peter Rayner chooses some neglected comedies. Michael Barson suggests rock and roll and monster movies and other B-films of the 50s. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews The Devil's Candy. It's reporter Julie Salomon's behind-the-scenes account of how Hollywood turned Tom Wolfe's best-selling novel, The Bonfire of the Vanities, into a big-budget film that bombed at the box office. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. According to various news reports from Moscow, Boris Yeltsin has seized the most sophisticated Soviet aircraft carrier for his Russian Federation. Reports indicate that former Soviet President Gorbachev went to his Kremlin office this morning to find out that Yeltsin has already moved in, with his nameplate on the door. At the same time, Yeltsin's vice president, who has publicly opposed his economic reform plans, has found his powers greatly curtailed. In New York City at the UN, Russian officials have started formally assuming the place once held by the former Soviet Union. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
In a letter released today, Russian President Boris Yeltsin formally notified the UN that his government was assuming the rights and responsibilities held by the Soviet Union. That includes the Soviet's permanent seat on the UN Security Council. Yeltsin also said the staff at the Soviet's UN mission would now represent Russia. That means the Soviet Union's highly respected UN delegate, Yuli Vorontsov, will be kept on the job for now. But Vorontsov told reporters today that his long-term status is somewhat unclear. He also said the Russian government would continue the Soviet Union's policy of peaceful cooperation with other Security Council members. Meanwhile, the tricolor Russian flag rose outside the UN for the first time this afternoon, while the Soviet flag, with its familiar hammer and sickle, was removed and placed in the UN archives. At the UN, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Rebel forces in the Georgian capital of Tbilisi continue to battle troops loyal to the local president. The fighting has continued now for almost 1 week. Carol Walker filed this report for the BBC.
President Zviadgan Sukurdia appears to be trying to sit it out in his fortified bunker beneath the immensely solid parliament building. The opposition forces say it's just a matter of time before he'll be forced to surrender, and today, certainly, they appear to be gaining the upper hand. Early this morning, they stormed a KGB and Interior Ministry building at the rear of the main parliament, starting a huge fire which blazed for much of the day. For many hours, they pounded the seat of their independent government with cannon, rocket, and heavy machine gun fire. They freed a number of political prisoners jailed earlier this year for their opposition to President Gamsakhurdia. One of them was Georgi Chanturia, leader of the National Democratic Party, who was greeted joyfully in the Hotel Tbilisi. Mr. Chanturia said President Gamsakhurdia was already effectively a political corpse.
Carol Walker reporting from Tbilisi, Georgia. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 18 points to close at 3,001.52, a new record high on volume of some 156 million shares. Trading was moderate. This is NPR News. The State Department says that the nation's long hostage ordeal is not considered over, despite return of remains believed to be those of former CIA employee William Buckley. A spokesman says that two German relief workers are still held in the Middle East, and information is also needed on several missing Israeli soldiers. The kidnappers of the two Germans are demanding the release of two men jailed in Germany, but the Berlin government has turned down that demand, and the State Department has again denied that any deal was made for the release of U.S. hostages. In Miami, the drug trial of former Panamanian leader Manuel Noriega has been delayed for several weeks. The judge in the trial has undergone surgery. Melissa Mancini reports.
Federal U.S. District Court Judge William Hoover underwent triple bypass surgery the day before Christmas. He had been complaining of tightness in his chest and went to the hospital. The 69-year-old Hoover is a graduate of Harvard Law School. He was appointed to the federal bench in 1977 by President Jimmy Carter. Hoover's unanticipated surgery will delay Noriega's drug trafficking and money laundering trial an additional 2 weeks. This delay is one of several health-related postponements that has plagued the three-month-old trial. Prior to Hoover's surgery, the trial was scheduled to resume after the holidays. Now it's been rescheduled for January 27th. For National Public Radio, I'm Melissa Mancini in Miami.
President Bush is in Texas for a long weekend of quail hunting. At the start of his trip, the president's airplane flew over some of the Texas counties hit hardest by heavy rainfall that is tied to over a dozen deaths and millions of dollars in damages. A White House spokesman said that by mid-afternoon, the Bush party had shot 19 quail. Tomorrow, a protest is planned by animal rights activists outside the ranch where the president is staying. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. What are you doing New Year's Eve? I'm going to stay home, rent some films, eat popcorn, and drink champagne. I rented films last year, and by the time I got to the video store, most of the movies were already gone. Obviously, there are lots of us renting movies on New Year's Eve. We thought you might want some recommendations for films you might not have thought of that would be fun to watch. In a little while, Michael Barson will recommend forgotten B-films of the 50s. First, we asked film critic Peter Rayner to recommend some neglected comedies and horror films. Rayner is a film critic for the Los Angeles Times and is president of the National Society of Film Critics. Let's start with comedies.
I'm not entirely kidding when I say that I think Woody Allen's masterpiece is a film called What's Up, Tiger Lily, which I don't know too many people know about. This is actually his first movie. It was made back in the 60s. But what he did was he bought the rights to a Japanese James Bond-style thriller and then dubbed in all of his own dialogue. So what you're essentially looking at is a dubbed Japanese film with people like Woody Allen and Louise Lasser doing all of the voices for these characters on the screen. And the plot, of course, is completely ridiculous and has something to do with the search for the perfect egg salad recipe. And there are intermittent cuts to the rock group The Lovin' Spoonful for no other reason than to cash in on the youth market at that time.
Okay, what else is on your list of comedies to rent?
Well, I love Preston Sturges, and there have been a number of books out about Sturges. There's even a collection of writings by him that was put together by his daughter last year. He's probably the greatest writer-director of comedies in Hollywood history, and I fear that, like so many of the movie people who kind of aren't current up to the last 5 years, that he's being forgotten by a whole new generation of filmgoers and potential film lovers. And I think his funniest and most neglected film is Unfaithfully Yours. It was remade with Dudley Moore a number of years ago, not very well, but this film was made in the late 40s. It stars Rex Harrison kind of doing a takeoff on Sir Thomas Beecham, and he's this insanely jealous conductor who feels that his wife is having an affair. His wife is played by Linda Darnell, and so the movie is a series of fantasies of how he would dispose of his wife and or her supposed lover, backed by the scores of Wagner and other operatic greats. And it's a very, very funny movie, extremely witty, it's probably the closest that any Hollywood writer has come to sort of Shavian dialogue, and it's really one of his best films and one of the best comedies ever made and one of the most neglected great comedies ever made.
Any comedy performance films you'd recommend?
Yeah, I happen to like all comedy performance films. I also like all stand-up comics because even when they're bad, I think it's sort of funny that they're bad. And often what they do to make up for the lack of laughs is funnier than the original joke. I think the funniest comedy performance film ever made is the first Richard Pryor movie, Richard Pryor Live in Concert. It's an amazing, amazing performance. I'm not entirely kidding when I say that it's probably the greatest performance I've ever seen, except for Olivier in Othello. It's an amazing one-character show where he not only plays himself and every aspect of his life, but he turns himself into various animals in the forest, in the jungle, Hollywood producer, his girlfriend, his wife. just every conceivable person. He just splits himself into a million guises, and it's an extraordinary piece of work. Pryor has never really come into his own as an actor in any of his own movies, but when he's himself playing his own comic persona on stage in this film, he's completely unparalleled. There's nothing like it. The second film that he did, Live in Concert at the Sunset Strip, which was done after his freebasing accident, is almost as funny and also a really great film. I would definitely put those at the top of any live performance list.
There's been a lot of good movies in the past decade that have opened very briefly, then closed and kind of disappeared without a trace. Some of those films are out on video. Any comedies in that category?
Well, there are a few. There was a very funny, neglected comedy a couple of years back called The Best of Times, which was with Kurt Russell. And it's a very funny movie written by Ron Shelton, who went on to write and direct Bull Durham. And it should have been better known than it is, but it really didn't get the lift that it should have. It's about, you know, trying to recapture your fame as a high school sports star, and now that you're middle-aged. And it sounds like a tired theme, but it's done with tremendous wit and humor. There was also a film in the early 80s called All Night Long with Gene Hackman and Barbara Streisand. That's a really wonderful comedy. But also has a kind of lyric, melancholy feeling to it. It was directed by Jean-Claude Tremont. It's the last film that he's directed. He's known as the husband of Sue Mengers, unfortunately, the famous agent, but he's really a wonderful director in his own right, and he's Belgian, so there's some kind of vaguely foreign film feeling to this American comedy that I think lifts it into a different category. But it's a wonderful little movie.
Do you have a favorite comedy of all time that's out on video?
Probably Some Like It Hot. I never fail to crack up at that one.
Let's move on to horror films. I think that's a popular genre for New Year's Eve, after all. It could be a frightening year ahead. What are some of your favorite horror films on video?
Well, there's a movie called Night of the Hunter, which was made in the early 50s. It's the only film ever directed by Charles Laughton. With a script by the great film critic James Agee, who later became a screenwriter and also worked on The African Queen. It stars Robert Mitchum as a deranged hillbilly preacher who marries into families with single mothers and then murders them for their inheritance. And it's one of the scariest movies ever made, although it does also have kind of weird humor to it also, because the children in this particular film are the ones who really understand that the preacher is a crazy man, whereas the adults all think he's just wonderful.
I'm surprised to hear you describe it as a horror film.
Well, I think has definite horror. There's definitely a horror to the movie when the preacher is following the kids at night, you know, by the water, and as you know, and the boy says, "Don't he never sleep?" And there's this real sense, I think, that children have that, you know, they're sort of being pursued by someone who is evil and who will stop at nothing and who literally does not sleep and sort of enters their dreams.
Any of the classic horror films that you'd recommend for New Year's Eve on tape?
Well, you know, Frankenstein and the original Dracula still hold up real well.
Sure do.
I mean, they're still really scary. The Mummy, I think, is one of the scariest movies ever made for some reason. Part of it is, I think, the primitiveness of some of these movies, I think, makes them even scarier now than some of the slicker kinds of scare films that you see today.
Peter Rayner is a film critic for the Los Angeles Times. He's one of the contributors to the new anthology Foreign Affairs, a video guide to foreign films. Michael Barson recommends renting some B-films of the 50s after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're looking for videos to rent this weekend or for New Year's Eve, remember that video has brought back a lot of forgotten B-films of the 50s. Michael Barson has edited several books of the original posters advertising these B-films. We asked him to recommend some films to rent, starting with rock and roll films of the 50s.
One of the great surprises I found last year for under $10, in fact, was the 1956 film Rock, 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 which starred Tuesday Weld when she was only 13. And she was already a presence, although when she sang in this film, it turns out that Connie Francis was dubbing her voice. But like many of the rock films from that 55, 56, 57 period, the plot was really just something to hang the appearances of some of the top acts on of the day, and this one had some of the all-time greats, Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, Chuck Berry, the Flamingos, and what I think is the only film appearance of the Johnny Burnett Trio. And there are other films that were cranked out to cash in on rock and roll, and sometimes this is the only way that some of the great acts were preserved, thanks to these films, because the ones that didn't make it onto Ed Sullivan had no other venue to appear. So these perform that great service of letting us see how they were at their peaks.
What other rock and roll films can you recommend?
Well, Mamie Van Doren was in a lot of films, Girls Town, Untamed Youth, but High School Confidential, where Jerry Lee Lewis comes on singing the credits, banging a piano in the back of a truck as he's sitting there, that's really one of the best. It involves a plot of teens pushing marijuana in high school to mix in with the rock and roll, and of course Mamie Van Doren herself, who's her own kind of iconography. That's another favorite of mine. The Elvis movies from the early period aren't bad. The Loving You is probably the best of those from 1957, but you don't want to really subject yourself to too many full-length Elvis movies. But I noticed that this year a collection of his trailers for just the 2 or 3 minute ads for each film was put out on video inexpensively, and that's perhaps the best way to sample Elvis without sitting through 90 minutes of Blue Hawaii or some other unspeakable things he did later in his career.
But you want to watch all of Jailhouse Rock.
Yes, Jailhouse Rock and Loving You are both excellent films from beginning to end with, you know, just terrific songs all the way.
Now, you also know a lot about cheap science fiction films.
Yes, this is, I guess, the category nearest and dearest to my heart, because growing up, I wasn't of the age where I could see many of them, and it always was just out of reach for me like candy. And now that they're becoming available on video, it's great to catch up with them. Just a few months ago, Zsa Zsa Gabor's Queen of Outer Space from 1958 was made available, and that is just a terrific movie about a race of women on Venus who are visited by a few Earthmen. A familiar plot, perhaps, but with Zsa Zsa in there, it's unique.
Any others to recommend? Science fiction, cheap films?
Some of the more famous monster ones are on tape now. The Blob, with a very young Steve McQueen. The Giant Claw, which was a monster bird attacking that looked pretty much like a plucked turkey, and it was a marionette, actually. So in terms of special effects, this definitely is in the grade Z rather than grade B category. And then some of the kind of good ones. It Came from Beneath the Sea, a giant octopus attacking San Francisco, animated by Ray Harryhausen, who was one of the best in the 50s. And Creature from the Black Lagoon is quite good. It's on video, and my two-year-old enjoys it immensely because every time the monster or his hand appears, the orchestra blares out, doo-doo-doo. So it's perfect for a party where you can talk for 10 minutes at a time and then just turn and watch the good parts, which are conveniently announced for you.
Well, this is an interesting point, though. If you're looking for family fare for New Year's Eve, you might want to think about good monster movies.
Yes, they're always fun. Some of them are really good, and some of them are so bad that they're good, but I can't imagine you'd get many complaints putting them on New Year's Eve. And if you're not familiar with a lot of the ones, there is a tape that's out now called Monster Mania, where just the trailers of about 30 of these things are shown. And, of course, the trailers always made each one look like the greatest movie ever made. And this has bits and pieces from things like The Creature from the Black Lagoon and Target Earth and The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. And it's a fun way to just get 2 or 3 minutes of highlights of each of these films.
Other Lost B films you'd recommend for us to rent on New Year's Eve?
Well, a couple that came out in 1991 after being unavailable for many years, slightly different categories. Gun Crazy, which was originally released in 1949, just a terrific picture about a Bonnie and Clyde type of couple who rob banks and eventually come to a bad end, although that's really not doing the film justice. It was directed by Joseph Lewis, and it's very, very exciting, and the low budget didn't hurt at all the drama of it, and it's really a lost classic, and to have it around again is terrific. And from that same year, 1949, a movie that's nowhere near as good as Gun Crazy, but is certainly immensely enjoyable, The Red Menace, which was put out at the height of the Red Scare, and in fact put out by Republic partly to pacify the HUAC investigators, because at that time every studio was very worried about being investigated. And this is just absolutely great loony stuff about the Reds in Los Angeles who are going to take over the United States after they get finished with their little basement meetings about party doctrine. And there's no name actor in it at all, but it's just hilarious. Everybody makes a speech every time they speak, and they all come to bad ends. And it's just a terrific thing that you couldn't find for many, many decades.
A good film to celebrate the end of the Cold War.
Well, yes, indeed. Now that we can see that we've won, you can enjoy even more the total lunacy of some of these hysterical things that came out during that 40s and 50s period.
So, Michael, what will you be doing on New Year's Eve?
Well, I'll probably be watching some combination of these. I am not going to attend a party, but again, since my little lads seem to like these, I guess we'll just go from one to another until it's time to celebrate the new year.
I wish you a very happy new year.
Well, same to you, Terry. Thanks.
Michael Barson is completing a book on communist scare memorabilia called Better Dead Than Red. His collection of romance comics, Boy Loves Girl, Girl Loves Boy, will be published in early 1992. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. The body of William Buckley has been found in Lebanon. Buckley was killed while being held hostage. He was held there for 8 years' time. Also, Verdemé Grobner goes to South Africa for a report on political exiles returning to that country. The Tundra Times, a weekly newspaper in Alaska, has closed down. It was begun back in the early 1960s as a way to bring the Alaska Native communities together. Very instrumental to the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act that was passed. And a report tonight about Democratic candidates for president, a review of their foreign affairs experience, or lack of foreign affairs experience.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. You may have read Tom Wolfe's book, Bonfire of the Vanities, and you may be one of the many people who stayed away from the movie adaptation. How the bestseller was turned into a big-budget bomb is the subject of the new book, The Devil's Candy, by Wall Street Journal film critic Julie Salomon. Book critic John Leonard recommends it.
I happened not to be an admirer of Tom Wolfe's famous novel, in which every single black person was a liar or a demagogue, all the women were mindless tinker toys. Nobody in New York ever went to a movie or a deli or a ball game. 100,000 homeless didn't exist, nor the real estate tycoons who made those homeless possible. And the problem with our criminal justice system was that innocent white Yale grad junk bond salesmen couldn't get a fair shake. Bonfire was a bestseller, partly because it was what the rest of the country wanted to believe about New York, and partly because Wolf is such a marvelous promoter of himself, a right-wing Andy Warhol. In his white suit, he could sell us anything from ice cream to Armageddon. Then I saw the movie. Oh my. The novel was at least an act of language. For Wolf's zippy satiric style, his jet stream and jazz fugue, Brian De Palma substituted tricky camera angles. The city as seen from a pigeon's point of view, or a sewer's, through a lens of bloodshot eye, or dirty lollipop. What happened to the class hatred, the homophobia, and the shoes? Wolf's a Matisse of shoes, and Wolf, I thought, should sue. In The Devil's Candy, Julie Solomon tells us just what happened. Solomon's a film critic and a banking reporter for the Wall Street Journal. She could only have written her wonderful book because De Palma, the director of the misbegotten movie, let her on the set. Nobody else wanted her around while they were doing whatever it is they do, including De Palma's buddy Spielberg. From Solomon, we learn that De Palma, who turned down Batman, obviously had a death wish and a weight problem. And there seems to have been something wrong with almost everybody else connected to the $50 million that went down the drain. Tom Hanks, miscast as master of the go-go greedhead universe Sherman McCoy, had to have his bad teeth capped. Bruce Willis, maybe not so miscast as a tabloid sleazeball reporter, had to have his bald head sprayed, which did nothing to make him less obnoxious. Melanie Griffith, Tinker Toy, took time out in mid-production to get her breasts fixed. Morgan Freeman, playing the judge, was black instead of Jewish, cost $1 million after they were already over budget and behind schedule, and couldn't remember his lines. Upwardly failing producers Peter Guber and Mark Canton, who called Bonfire the best movie we've ever made, both quit Warner's for Sony. And if you ever wondered why Time Warner chairman Steve Ross takes home $80 million a year, just remember he was shrewd enough to sell losers like Guber and Canton to the Japanese for $800 million. We aren't talking about what Pauline Kael once called a bastard cross-fertilized super art. We're talking about a delusional system that amounts to mass psychosis. What these people don't know about art, they don't know about money either. Solomon likes De Palma, but he was as crazy as the rest of them, and Hollywood's as crazy as Wall Street, and the only good to have come from so much wasted money and wasted talent is the best book about the movies since Nathaniel West's The Day of the Locust, which seems in the wicked light of The Devil's Candy to have been too gentle and too kind, almost a puff piece.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Devil's Candy by Julie Solomon. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk, Orji Voblaitis, and Ron Barron. Roberta Shurrock directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In an attempt to end the recession, the Federal Reserve has lowered interest rates. That's good news if you plan on taking out a loan, but it's bad news for your savings account. On the next Fresh Air, financial expert Jane Bryant Quinn has some advice about spending and saving while interest rates are low. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.